You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
In terms of earnings, Alex, it's another big day for the big banks, Bank of America and Morgan Stanley. Allison Williams joins us. She is the senior bank analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. She is the expert on these big banks. Alex, let's start with one of my former employers, Bank of America, Merrill Lynch. I'm going to keep that name in the name. There wouldn't be an investment bank if it weren't for Merrill Lynch. Talk to us about what we saw at Bank of America, Allison.
So I think the Merrill Lynch side of things did very well, so making you proud there.
Thank you.
The wealth fees came in better than expected. Equities trading and equities fees also better than expected. So continuing to build on some of those investments in the investment bank. So everything going well there. And actually on the net interest income, sort of a standout result in the sense that their net interest income actually increased from the prior quarter. It was better than expected. So that all sounded great until we got to the conference call, and the bank really just kept their guidance steady. And so I think that's what the stock may be reacting to today. But really, I mean, that's consistent with the other banks. And frankly, I think makes sense. We had, look at the change we had since the last time the banks reported. Last time they reported it was 6 to 7 cuts expected. Today, I mean, it's been 3 and drifting lower, right? So those expectations keep getting pushed out. And with things changing so dramatically, I don't think it's surprising that they kept their guidance stable. I would point out that their guidance is a little bit more positive in the sense that they do expect growth in the second half. I think just maybe ahead of the call, people got excited and thought, you know, could we have already seen the trough? And they're saying, no, second quarter is going to be the trough.
Well, maybe it was the 17 uses of strong in the statement that kind of raised that expectation. Also, what was interesting, though, was the charge-off. So that increased by about $306 million to $1.5 billion. Can you talk us through? I know that's the bank side of the business, the everyday banker side of the business. But what's going on there?
And that you know, that is the other part of it. And so, you know, when we think about core lending income, it's the net interest income is the revenue side, and provisions are a key part of the cost side of things, obviously operating costs the other part. And what we saw was charge-offs came in higher than expected. Part of that was card. We do expect that from card. It's a seasonally higher quarter. Delinquencies tend to be lower, and they are signaling improvement from here. So that's a negative, but as I said, sort of in line with the trends on the commercial real estate. Charge-offs higher than expected, and the bank talked about changing some of their revaluation and their model sort of feeding into this. But basically, you know, looking forward to the future quarters, they think that things might look a little bit better. But for the quarter, things weaker on commercial real estate. We know that that's a hot button issue for investors. It's something we've said. It's going to be a long story to play out. So sometimes a little better, sometimes a little worse. But Wells Fargo, we did actually see some improvement in their non-performers. And so I think that was more negative for Bank of America.
Allison, what is Bank of America saying about loan growth? I mean, are their corporate bankers, are they making loans, or do the customers need capital? What are they seeing?
They are, but it's your friends at Merrill Lynch that are making the loans, and not, you know, sort of that middle market asset-based type business. So we saw, you know, the debt issuance this quarter, we saw very strong, and we've heard mixed things from banks in terms of if they think some of that has been pulled forward. But the bottom line is capital markets very strong, but, you know, the bread and butter lending business, those loan balances coming in weak and weaker than expected. And so that's another piece to the net interest income is, you know, how much of it relates to securities and higher yielding securities. Whereas the loan growth, you know, has been weak. And if we don't get those Fed cuts, you know, are we going to get some improvement? And so Bank of America, I think, has some improvement baked into its net interest income guidance. But I think there could be some skepticism out there, you know, if the rates stay high, you know, we're already seeing that impacting demand. Could that continue to be soft?
And then wrapping up here, Morgan Stanley, that stock is up by about 3.7%. What stood out to you? They seem to kind of fire on all the cylinders.
They did. I mean, they delivered on all of their key metrics. Number one, the wealth flows. We had really strong wealth flows first half of last year that softened. So we're showing a little bit of a rebound. So that's definitely a positive. Equity trading coming in better than expected. Equity fees coming in better than expected. Pretty much, you know, all of the investment banking lines except for M&A coming in better. So that's all good. And then the profit margin, which is the other key thing investors focus on, coming in, you know, about 26%. And so that's in line with the revised guidance. Keep in mind, they do have a 30% target near term. They said, long term, near term, they said it's going to be a little bit lower because of investments. So coming in, beating the consensus and within their target. So, you know, there's some modest negatives in the quarter, but in general, hitting all the high points and so I think restoring some confidence for Morgan Stanley.
So, Allison, where are we just in terms of the big investment banks in terms of headcount? Are they where they need to be? Do they need more downsizing? Where are they?
I think, Paul, that really is going to depend on if we can get some sustained momentum investment banking fees. So, you know, all the managements generally spoke very positively in terms of what we're seeing, you know, talking about the IPOs getting better reception. Maybe there's some better outlook there. Morgan Stanley today just talking about the fact that, you know, at some point companies need to execute on things that they need to do in terms of either going public or doing deals, et cetera. But I do think that a lot of the headcount has really been conservative in terms of the cuts we've seen since the boom because we had such a scramble in that, you know, record 2021 time period. As you recall, all the headline stories about the scramble for talent and ratcheting up of pay of junior talent.
Yep.
And so it's really going to depend on if we can see that sustained momentum in investment banking and then that headcount gets put to work. If we are disappointed, there could be sort of another look at things, unfortunately.
Didn't they all, they paid up for that though, right?
Yeah.
Like I feel like they had to definitely shell out the money to those bankers this quarter in a different way, no?
And compensation revenue in general has been a lot stickier. And so we definitely saw that last year. This quarter, we saw the compensation ratios coming in, you know, about in line, showing some good cost control at companies like Morgan Stanley and Goldman, where we have the most visibility. However, keep in mind, it was a really strong revenue quarter. So, again, we're going to want to see that revenue continue to support the compensation.
Hey, just real quickly, 30 seconds. I see that Citigroup is the best performing of the big banks here year to date. Is this finally Jane Fraser getting this thing moving?
I mean, I think it is, and I think they do have, you know, they have a positive story. And they have the most potential for improvement. So even though their returns are the weakness, they have a path. And you know, Jane Fraser really making some tough moves. We know that Citigroup has been, you know, a story of restructuring, it seems like forever, but really making some dramatic cuts and layers, you know, focusing on the core businesses, you know, really taking an axe to some core markets. So I think there is a story there. Also, credit card, as we said, you know, we've talked about card as the business that's growing in loans, not the commercial. And so that's helping Citigroup. They're the most exposed.
Right. And they're a big player there. Yep. All right, Allison, great stuff as always. Allison Williams, Senior Bank Analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. Breaking down some of the big banks again today, Morgan Stanley, Bank of America. We had J.P. Morgan last week. So some pretty solid results coming out of the big banks.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
So we're here at the Bloomberg NEF Annual Energy and Climate Summit. So it brings together corporate executives, government officials, industry leaders to talk about the stuff that's going on in the energy industry, in particular clean power, trade, federal U.S. policy, hydrogen, clean tech, all the stuff. Now, a key figure in all of this comes from D.C., and his name is David Crane. He's Undersecretary for Infrastructure in the U.S. Department for Energy. He was also CEO of NRG for about 12 years back in the day, and his job is to make all of this stuff work in a realistic fashion. Good luck, David. How's it going?
Thank you. Well, as you said, there's a lot of stuff
going
on.
There's a lot of stuff. So something I was, you had a speech and or a panel, and something that you said that really stuck out. You said demand growth in the U.S. for power is going to be more than we thought. For the last 10 years, so 2012 to 2022, power demand was up just 50 basis points a year. And now we're looking at 5% to 6% a year. I tell that to Paul and his eyes glaze over. But it's really important. What does that actually mean?
Well, 5% to 6% in our world is huge. I mean, that's like tiger economies from the 1990s. And because of the long lead time of most things in the electricity sector, those 5% to 6% per year pile up if you're not getting after it. So what it means is, and what's very important in all this as we look at these transitioning to the clean energy economy, all these new technologies, is you always have to ask the time question. What do you need in what time frame, and what are the solutions that fit, that land within that time frame?
You know, a couple of summers ago, my summer read was The Grid, fraying wires between Americans and our energy future.
You read that?
I read that on the beach, and people were laughing at me,
so
like, what a geek.
Paul.
So I feel like I know what I'm talking about here. And what I know is we need constant investment in our energy grid. And if Alex is right, that energy demand is going to keep increasing, that's even more so. What are some of the key issues that you need to tackle or trying to tackle, at least in the short term here?
Well, first of all, I need to tackle what your summer reading is
yes.
on the beach, because, Paul, I think you got to get a life if,
yeah,
that's,
exactly.
what if that's what you're... I think, well, I mean, one big one, the missing link, and I mentioned this on stage as well, is permitting reform.
Okay.
I mean, we're very supportive of permitting reform. It takes a lot of different permutations. I'm personally not a policy person. I'm the implementation person, but... we just need to do things faster, because just the scale of infrastructure that exists under this new legislation, just in my area, by the end of this year, we will have invested in over 100 infrastructure projects that are over $100 million each. And so we're straining the system in many different ways, but permitting should not be the bottleneck.
So to break that down a little bit, when we say permitting, what are we talking about? And I say that in terms of, like, are we going to have to move power lines underground, for example? Do we need more transmission lines if we're going to set up that hydrogen hub or a new nuclear facility and we need to get that to the grid? Does it mean we need to just try and start over and, like, do a new grid? Like, there's a lot of ways that infrastructure can be used. What does it actually mean for you?
Well, of the two that you mentioned specifically.
Any of them. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I would leave aside undergrounding wires, because that's more of a climate mitigation thing. It's where you need to do it. It's very important. But in terms of solving the demand issue, the transmission thing breaks into sort of two parts. And the answer is yes and yes. We need both. One is we need more transmission lines to move the energy around the country, or at least around regions. But then we also need this thing, which is grid innovation, which is a series of technologies which are not in the popular mindset, things like reconductoring, where you basically take an existing rights of way in the towers and you take down the ceramic circular things and and in some cases the wires, and you what we call reconductoring. And you can get 2 to 3 times the amount of power over the same line.
Oh,
and you don't need a right of way. It's cheaper, and that's good for ratepayers. And we just, in fact, published a report about this today at the DOE called the Grid Innovation Liftoff Report. And so there's that, and there's a host of other things. But basically, we need all of the above right now.
And is this a federal funded issue, or is this a federal and state issue? Does it go, how local does it get? Because I think of Texas with its own grid. And I'm wondering how should they be integrated, for example, into the national grid? I mean, I don't.
They're not going to want that.
Yeah, I don't know exactly.
Yeah, Paul, that's what I'm not touching. I mean, there's a reason that Texas is a sovereign unto itself.
Yes, exactly.
when it comes to their electric system. But most so we have a lot of financing tools in the tool chest, but most of them are set up as sort of matching funds. We put up to 50% against 50% coming from basically anywhere else that's not federal government.
Okay.
So we say 50%+ from non-federal sources. And if it's states, if it's the private sector, that's all good with us.
And that's what you need to see in order to commit the money after that.
Yes, yeah.
So how does this all square? So the stuff you're talking about, like reconstituting the grid like that, like that's not sexy cool stuff, like clean tech and hydrogen, right?
Yeah.
How much of your job is on the energy that we're going to need in 50 years, and how much of that is how do we get more transmission mechanisms? How do we get that plug that we can't get so we can change the grid?
You know, Alex, I was getting a little hung up on what's actually sexy in the world of electricity, but I'm glad that you can distinguish between hydrogen on one and transmission. But what I'd say is, first of all, nothing that if I thought that what I was doing was just affecting things in 2050, like, you know, at my age, I wouldn't be doing it. But we're aiming for the Biden administration goal of zero carbon electric sector by 2035. And so, but the premise of your question is correct. Because of this new awareness of demand issues, I would say that what I've been focused on my 2 years at the DOE is what does the system look like sort of between 2028 to 2035? First of a kind, fast following commercial. But because of this new concern, I think we're going to be even looking at more 3 to 5 year solutions. And that's where things like the grid innovation is important, because that's a 3 to 5 year solution. Hmm.
David, what are you seeing from the major utility companies in the United States? Are they making the investments they need to make this transition?
Will they be allowed to by the regulators?
Exactly.
Well, first of all, I think that what I would say just in the last year and talking to the utility CEOs, and I would bet a lot of money that you're going to be talking to some here on your show today, so they can probably speak for themselves, is, first of all, there's now universal concern about this where that didn't exist a year before. I think they're still in the situation where their chief financial officers are saying, look, this is a really expensive time to raise money in the private sector. And we have a program within our loan program office called the 1706 program, which utilities qualify for. And at current prevailing interest rates, the interest advantage, but I'm told by utilities, is somewhere between 115 and 200 basis points. And we go large.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have $250 billion of loan capacity. So we're working with a bunch of utilities to see if that could become part of their cap structure. But as you say, they're under pressure not to raise rates. And it's just the nature of investment in electric infrastructure is like you build something today, you know, it has to be paid for today. The benefits of it, you know, play out over 50 years.
Right.
But so it is a tension, but no one wants to run out of power.
No, and I guess one of the key issues that I feel like has really pivoted interest in the sector is AI and data centers, right? Like we all knew you got to plug in an EV that's going to use electricity. We all knew that stuff. But now that people really seem to care because tech companies care, do you spend a lot of time talking to tech companies? Do they call you or they call someone else in your office?
Increasingly, if you would, I would say, you know, the DOE, when I got there, had sort of their natural constituencies like, you know, traditional energy companies, new energy companies, mm-hmm. but the tech companies have loomed larger and larger and have become more and more frequent visitors, and at very high levels too, not just, you know, the data center person, mm-hmm. like the senior executives yeah. of these. So, and that's very important because I think they're a huge partner in this. And, you know, the thing about electricity is we always used to say in the era of big power plants, supply would be added in big chunks, but demand would grow and there'd be occasional imbalances. But now with these data centers, demand is growing in these big chunks and in specific places, which they won't tell you where they are,
right.
right? Because that's one of their competitive secrets, right? So we need to have a partnership with them, and overall, I think it's a great thing.
All right, David, thanks a lot. It was really great to get your perspective. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Alex,
thank you so much.
Great to see you again.
David Crane, Undersecretary for Infrastructure at the DOE. You really read that book on BK?
I did.
Damn.
Yep, Keith Grossman recommendation.
You win.
Yep, very good.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Paul and I, we are here, Intercontinental Hotel, right here in Midtown Manhattan at the Bloomberg NEF Summit, where you have global leaders, you have thought leaders, you have CEOs kind of getting together and discussing the clean energy, green energy transition, how to get there, and also how to satisfy the demand for power that we're seeing right now, which is enormous. Joining us here now on site is Pedro Pizarro, President and CEO of Edison International. And there's two buckets for you, right? Like, how do you decarbonize the grid and get to that goal? And then how do you match the power demand today from data centers, AI, to people wanting charging their EVs at home? Let's go to the latter first. What kind of demand are you seeing? Who's calling you up?
Well, I can tell you from a Southern California Edison perspective, our utility, we had had flat growth for the last 15 years. We're now seeing something like 2% load growth. And in our state, a lot of it is transportation electrification. I'm also chair of the Edison Electric Institute, which represents the investor-owned utilities across the country, about 70% of the load. 2 years ago, EEI members were forecasting something like a 2% load growth over the next years ahead. The most updated numbers are 4.7%.
Wow.
And I have colleagues in some states that are seeing 5, 6, 7%. So who's calling? It is electrification in places like California, more broadly across the country, but I think we're more leading edge there. It is data center growth, which you've read a lot about that. And then it's also the repatriation of manufacturing. You know, the bipartisan infrastructure law is working, and it's bringing back a lot of manufacturing into the country, and that's another source.
Oh, interesting.
So can you, being your company and your industry, can you handle that increase in load?
Yes. There will be some bumps in the road, right? I was sharing with Alex earlier that it's not the first time in our history of the industry we've seen this, right? Rural electrification, air conditioning load. So we've lived through these periods. It's been the last 15 years or so that it's been fairly flat. So how do we handle it? In the near term, right, you see a lot of focus of utilities working in their various regions, power companies, working with regional transmission organizations, and working with customers too, make sure we're using every tool available. demand side management is important. Energy efficiency is important. But so is making sure that we can maintain and in some cases expand existing resources. And ultimately, we need to add new resources to the system.
How do you pay for that? Because as yields have moved higher, stock moves lower, and then it's more expensive to borrow. How do you do it?
Well, you know, it is an investment in infrastructure that's needed. And this is an industry that's been investing for a long time. Our members at EEI have invested over $1 trillion over the last decade on infrastructure, $168 billion last year alone. Right?
But so that's eventually the ratepayer, right?
It is eventually the ratepayer, right? And so we have a responsibility to make sure that that investment is economic, is being done thoughtfully, is being done efficiently. But importantly, this investment has multiple uses, right? There is the near-term need to keep up with demand, but there's also the longer-term need for investing towards decarbonization, right? And the industry's been going as clean as we can, as fast as we can, but while maintaining reliability and affordability. And so those investments are the same investments that are needed to build out the transmission grid, to add renewable resources, to add storage, and that helps with climate change mitigation. There's also investment that we're needing to put in to deal with climate change adaptation, right? The effects of extreme weather, the effects we've seen initially in California and now across
everywhere.
The country in wildfire, right? So my own company has been investing billions of dollars to redesign the system to harden it against wildfires. Other colleagues are having to do that now. So all of these investments accrue to the customer, customer benefit, whether it's to keep the system safer, keep communities safer, and also to support the demand growth that we're seeing.
So Pedro, just before earlier this morning, Alice and I spoke to David Crane, Undersecretary for Infrastructure at the U.S. Department of Energy, and he said one of his major goals over the next several years is to make permitting easier, so presumably to allow companies like yours to make these investments and maybe in a quicker manner. Are you seeing that, or what do you need to see?
Absolutely need it.
Okay.
And so if you gave me a magic wand and gave me one wish for the industry, it would be that.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't blame you.
All right. I mean, and we have other challenges, supply chain, labor availability, but it's really siting and permitting that needs the most help. Just to frame it for you a little bit, Paul, the analysis that we've done as Edison for California and what will it take to decarbonize the whole California economy by 2045, you know, it's a state's net zero goal, still feasible, right? But it will require significant investment for renewables, for storage, for the grid, $370 billion of investment statewide through 2045. That analysis, by the way, from an affordability perspective, back to your comment earlier, Alex, we do see that that will put pressure on electric rates and bills, but because it's a transition, right? A lot of that electrification will be removing uses in the economy that today are using combustion processes with fossil fuels. These are more efficient technologies, right? The electric car is more efficient than an internal combustion engine car. We see the total energy bill for our average customer, electric plus gas plus gasoline, going down by 40% in real terms between now and 2045. So that goes to these investments having a co-benefit of affordability. As we look at how we, you know, proceed with this kind of investment, you know, we have to keep in mind that it has those multiple benefits.
So that all of it has to work at the same time for that to be that 40% decline.
Absolutely. And we need to be able to get the steel in the ground through siting and permitting.
Right. Yep.
And so part of our analysis showed that the rate at which we add transmission will need to be 4 times the annual rate that it's been historically. The rate at which we add distribution, the lower voltage wires, will need to be 10 times the rate. So when David Crane talked about siting and permitting, absolutely needed. And it's help that we need at both the federal and the state and even the local levels.
Before we let you go, when you talk about types of energy, what are you looking at? What means green to you?
A lot of things, and we need all of it, right? It's the traditional renewables that are commercially available today, like onshore wind, solar, geothermal. It's new technologies. Offshore wind, next generation geothermal that might be using, you know, horizontal drilling techniques. It's nuclear, right? Because nuclear is carbon free. And so investments needed there. Storage. Today, we're really relying on lithium ion chemistry. We need different chemistries. And the Department of Energy has been a prime mover in investing, putting our tax dollars to good work to find alternate chemistries. So it really is all of the above.
If I'm an investor, do I invest in the utility industry? It seems like you guys got years and years and years of investment. What do you tell investors as to the returns that you try to deliver?
It's a long, good road ahead in terms of the infrastructure investment that's needed through our industry. At our company, we talk about how we have set a growth rate guidance, 5 to 7% earnings per share growth rate from now through 2028. We see that that need for investment is supported both by these immediate needs, but also by long-term state policy in California. I think, you know, my peers across the country are all seeing a similar sort of phenomenon where the investment is absolutely needed. It's core to the economy. The electric sector is 5 or 6% of GDP, but it powers the other 94, 95%.
There you go. All right, Pedro Pizarro, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Pedro Pizarro, President and Chief Executive Officer of Edison International here at the Bloomberg New Energy Finance Conference here in the the hotel in Midtown Manhattan, looking at the energy transition to cleaner energies.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
We are live from an Intercontinental Hotel right here on 48th Street in Midtown Manhattan. We're at Bloomberg's NEF Annual Energy and Climate Summit, bringing together corporate executives, government officials, and industry leaders, all to talk about how we get to clean energy, what the policy is like, what the clean power is like, and how we get there. A big part of that story is actually going to be technology. It's the AI and the data centers that are in part responsible for the huge bump in power demand that we're going to see over the next few years. So luckily, we have someone who has to deal with this on a day-to-day basis. We are joined now by Amanda Peterson-Corio. She's Global Head of Data Center Energy at Google. So great to be here with you.
Thank you so much for joining. Thank you for having me. My pleasure.
So you're the person that like has to power the data centers and call up the power providers and energy companies and be like, guys, help me out?
It's not me. It's a whole team of people. So I am not the sole person doing that. But yes, that our job is really to figure out how do we enable Google to grow and how do we do that in a way that's sustainable load growth over time.
All right. So what we hear, what Alex and I hear from, really we've just started learning about this over the last couple of years, is the demand from a lot of these technology companies. And we've had CEOs of utilities say, I'm talking to you tech executives these days. I've never talked to them in the past.
Yeah.
What are you trying to do? As you think about the next 5 to 10 years of Google's energy needs,
yeah,
you're not just going to plug into a coal plant, I'm guessing.
No, absolutely
not. So what are you thinking about these days?
So I think we're doing a number of things, right? We see, as you mentioned, a wave of demand growth that we haven't seen in the last 2 decades in the U.S. It's been pretty flat to stagnant. Data centers, as you mentioned, are getting a lot of attention, but actually they're just a part of really what's a reindustrialization and electrification of manufacturing, transport, heating, right? And yep. Digitization is just one role of that. And so we have to look at that and think about how are we going to grow in this new market landscape. We do a few things. We see our role in working in partnership with our utilities to figure out how can we bring new firm capacity, so not just clean energy, but firm clean capacity to the grid so that we can really meet those demand needs over the next decade. We also look at how we can do things more efficiently because really what the challenge we're seeing is the amount of growth we have over the next decade collectively on the system. So what we're trying to do is make new efficient processes. So last year we innovated a new way to buy and sell electricity, reducing the time by 80% with our partners at Level 10 Energy. And this enabled us to get 1.5 gigawatts, again, in 80% of the time it used to take us in just 1 year. So things like this is how we're working in partnership to meet that need.
Oh, so many questions. Okay, so the first one is, is it going to be just for the data centers, we take that? Is it going to be, let me just plug that data center into the grid? Or is it going to be that these data centers become their own sort of mini power generators, either by having like a small nuclear reactor near them to power it? How do you see that relationship evolving?
Yeah, I mean, there's many forms to get power, as you pointed out. The most efficient and the best is to be grid connected, right? The reason we have an electricity grid is the evolution of it. It doesn't make sense to have all of these.
But does that imply that if you turn on your data center, I lose my electricity?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
Not at all. Actually, data centers actually provide a lot of voltage stabilization to the grid because we're a firm and constant load over time. No, when we connect to a grid, we ensure that we're also bringing in new generation, new transmission to help power and expand the grid. Definitely not take away from the electricity that's already providing services to others.
So I'm guessing you can't do it alone. I'm guessing there's going to be some partnerships along the way. I know you've got one with Microsoft and Nucor.
Yep.
Tell us about that and how that could be a template for...
Yeah, so one of the challenges we saw is exactly what I just touched on, that we're seeing a lot of intermittent capacity from new clean generation, but we're not seeing the same uptick in firm clean capacity onto the grid, and that's because this technology is still more nascent relative to more traditional thermal assets like gas generators. And so we said we've got to show that the demand is there. And so we've partnered with Microsoft and Nucor to say, let's aggregate our demand and think about how we can drive scale, basically, for this new tech and get that onto the grid faster. So we announced this a few weeks ago. We're here with them today. We're going to speak at a lunch session today to say more about what we're looking for, how we can help, and really trying to drive that.
Going back to how data centers provide stability to the grid, how? I've heard that a lot, that like a data center can help provide electricity because you're price sensitive. I don't know. I've heard lots of things. How do you help?
I mean, part of it is that unlike you who may be turning on your lights at early in the morning or late at night and then dropping the day, that's hard for the grid to manage and frequency regulation. A data center is predictable, and having predictable load is something that utilities and the grid greatly value because then they can plan better around it and not have to turn on and off generation resources.
I see, okay.
All right, so when I look at the CapEx line of Google, and it's the GDP of more than most countries here, and a lot of it is building new data centers and capacity there. Do they come to you like day one and say, where can I get the cheapest energy? Where can I get the most efficient energy? How does the energy aspect come into all the CapEx that they're spending in terms of data centers?
Yeah, absolutely. We're part of the data center team that goes out and decides where do we site our next data center, what makes sense, and power is absolutely at the core of everything we do. As mentioned, it's where do we have access to that clean capacity that can really deliver us growth, but also what markets can we participate in that give us the ability to have customer choice. We operate in over 80 electricity grids around the world.
Wow.
No two,
wow,
unfortunately, are the same. but some, we have a lot of choice. In deregulated markets and RTOs, but there's a lot more we can do and partner with. In markets that are fully regulated, we are looking to partner with our utilities to say, hey, how can we innovate? How can we evolve? Mm-hmm. How can we take what the same old tariff that we did for 10 years, how do we make that different to meet the needs of our time?
That's what I was wondering about, being your own little power generator, like partnering with a company and having its own, your own nuclear power station, for example, to power that data center. Is that something that we're going to see, that kind of model?
I think we're exploring absolutely all options. As you've seen, it's been very hard to grow nuclear in this country. so we have to look at that, and we're hoping that's one of the technologies we're absolutely looking at in this partnership with Microsoft and Nucor.
Have you had to be turned away at all? Like, have you like been sourcing an area and then you talk to the utility and the utility's like, I can't do this for you, I'm sorry. Has that happened yet?
I think it's more, you know, I like to talk about the grid and meeting capacity as you can do it with time. So it's just a matter of when do you need to serve load versus how quickly can you build whatever it is, transmission or generation, to serve that load. And so what we have found is maybe we can't always meet our time schedules on the time that we would like, and so we have to look at other options.
I see. That's interesting.
How's the U.S. grid versus others you've seen around the world?
Oh, boy. That is a big question that we do not have time today. Well, first of all, the U.S. isn't one grid. As you know, it's many grids.
Yep.
And so I think in explaining that to people, it's hard for them to understand. Again, you have a mix of everything here in the U.S., which is very different. When we talk about the rest of the world, we talk about Europe. Europe is a really interesting integrated system because you're actually going cross countries. And I think it actually, there's a lot of things that work really well there. Within our own country, we have trouble going across states.
Yep.
Okay.
And building that transmission to deliver the generation to where the loads are actually located. So I think that's some of the interesting challenges. Other places in the world, each country really has its own unique system. It's only Europe that you really see that multi-country grid really playing out.
Something that works for Europe. I honestly, that's something you usually don't hear. Before we let you go, when you talk about sort of the advanced clean technology and how you're working with Microsoft and Nucor, what do you think those advanced clean technologies are?
Yeah. There's a number of them. We talked about maybe seeing advanced nuclear. We already last year just had our first enhanced geothermal extraction project come online with Fervo here in the U.S., and so we're buying energy from that project. We're also looking at new techs, including carbon sequestration. It's going to have to be part of the solution in our view. And we continue to look at hydrogen and in long duration energy storage.
So interesting. Yeah. Amanda, thank you so much. Madam Peterson, Corio, Global Head of Data Center Energy over at Google. You don't get much sleep, do you?
I do not, actually. I took a red eye here, so.
Oh, there we go. Okay, I was just kidding, but I guess that's true. It's just so interesting because I feel like when I talk to my energy guys, you need these guys.
I know.
You need big tech companies to say, take this seriously or else it's going to be very hard to move the needle.
So what is your summer book going to be?
The grid.
The grid. The
yes.
grid. The grid. I will read it and we will compare notes.
Yes. Then we could talk to Amanda like at a little higher level.
The higher level. Okay. Yep. We'll do that.
Exactly.
We'll do that.
It's actually a pretty good grid. I learned a lot about electricity in the United States.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
I'm Alex D. alongside Paul Sweeney. We are Bloomberg Intelligence Radio, and we are live at Intercontinental Hotel right here in Midtown Manhattan for Bloomberg NEF Summit, where we talk to all the leaders and policymakers and CEOs on how we get from where we are now and then to decarbonize in the next three decades. Well, joining us now is a very special guest, Ethan Zindler, climate counselor for the U.S. Department of Treasury, which is already cool. But the cooler part is he used to work at Bloomberg NEF, and it's been a while since I've seen you. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
How's your different job in D.C.?
It's definitely different, but it's great.
Do they have snacks like they did in
No. I bring bags of almonds in from time to time.
He doesn't get the almonds.
Yeah,
okay.
Which we share.
Well, that's one. Oh, that's so nice.
Yeah.
All right, so let's talk about what you're working on right now. What is your job as a climate counselor to the U.S. Department of Treasury?
So, you know, the Treasury Department is across a lot of different things in the climate space, and we have multiple divisions that are working on things, everything from the International Affairs Office, the Domestic Finance Office. We have a federal insurance office that thinks about some of these climate issues as well. So my job really is to try to coordinate some of those activities across the department to collaborate on some of the key issues. And most often that's been on the Inflation Reduction Act, but other things as well. And also to provide some counsel to the secretary, as the title implies, on some of these key issues.
What are the key issues you guys are focusing on now? What are the most important mandates right now as we try to navigate this change?
Yeah, so there's a lot of things going on, but certainly the implementation of the Inflation Reduction Act is front and center for us at Treasury. A good deal, the majority of the funds overall that are aimed at clean and green initiatives would go through the tax code with all the rules written and implemented over time. And so a lot of what we spend our time on doing is writing some of those rules. So that's one thing. Other things, indeed, are on the international front, working with some of our partners and some of the multilateral development banks on some of the work that they're doing around evolution and thinking more around climate issues. The Treasury also works very closely with the Green Climate Fund and the other funds that are focused on multilateral climate development. So working with them on that stuff. And then finally, maybe one last topic is on insurance, which we've been doing a lot of work and thinking about as well.
So let's go to the IRA for a moment, because the big hubbubaloo was about hydrogen for a little while. So it was, how do you qualify for the hydrogen tax credit? Does the hydrogen need to come from clean energy? Can it be sort of carbon captured natural gas?
Yep.
Or can it be just straight up natural gas? That part of it sort of skated by okay. But then everyone started talking about how you qualify clean energy when it comes to hydrogen, an hour for hour or like sort of a yearly base load. And that was a big deal for a lot of these producers. Talk me through how you guys thought about it, what you think about it, what the problem was.
Sure. So first I'm going to stop and take credit for the fact that the IRA is, to be clear, the most important piece of climate legislation ever passed in the United States. And
no
the
doubt.
Level of investment that we've seen overall has been really pretty terrific. $250 billion by one count in the first 12 months after it passed, and we've seen over $600 billion in manufacturing since the start of this term. On the specifics of the 45V hydrogen tax credit, look, the way we wrote the rules, to be clear, a draft version of the rule, and we've drafted it, was that we effectively took our cue entirely from the law. And the law is very clear about saying that you had to think about what CO2 emissions were and referenced the Clean Air Act. It also referenced, not to get too wonky, a particular model for tracking emissions called the GREET model. And so we really wrote our draft guidance to be as compliant with that as we could, and that included taking into account what we called induced emissions. That's emissions that might be created by taking some of existing zero carbon generation and allocating it to something else. So we really sought to be as clear as we could. But again, to be clear, it's draft guidance, and we've certainly received comments. We've received, I would say, no less than 30,000 comments last I checked. So we're working our way through those, and stand by. We'll eventually have the final rule drafted this year.
So Ethan, as we make this transition to a cleaner sourcing of energy, one of the objectives I think is to reduce reliance on China and maybe some other folks around the world, and maybe onshore or friendshore more of our energy infrastructure. How does that factor into your work?
Quite a lot. I mean, I think it's something that the Secretary has been very out front on. I was with her last month in Chile, where we were having conversations with government leaders there about some of the opportunities around so-called friendshoring. And we visited a lithium hydroxide processing plant where that lithium is being exported to the U.S. and elsewhere to make batteries. The Secretary has also had some very direct and candid conversations with Chinese leadership, and just got back from Beijing last Wednesday, and these issues around oversupply and overcapacity are things that have come up, but it's also our view that it's very important and productive to continue to have conversations. And so actually almost at this very moment, we're continuing with those back at the Treasury Department through two working groups that we have ongoing with the Chinese to continue those conversations.
I was at an energy function in Houston a couple weeks ago, and Secretary Granholm was there, and she was basically like, guys, there is money in D.C., come get it. Are we spending too much money in a short amount of time? Like, not that we don't need the money over time, but there's a condensed period with which it can be spent. Are you worried about throwing money into bad stuff or things that aren't going to get the job done or things that are not going to return as much?
I would just say this, that I think this is a really critical and important time. I think the Inflation Reduction Act has created an inflection point where we have an opportunity now to be supportive of these technologies in a way we've never done before, and it's important that we seize that going forward. And I think we feel pretty good that we're doing that at this point. There's a lot more work to be done, and to be honest with you, we're working around the clock through the rest of this year and beyond. But no, I think that this is a unique opportunity. And look, the clock's not, the clock's not getting any quieter on climate change, and we really need to have these technologies developed further and deployed further, particularly some of the ones in the harder to decarbonize sectors like industrial processes.
Ethan, just 30 seconds. What's the next milepost people like me should be looking for, people that don't track this every day?
Good question. I think we work in increments, I guess, in the Treasury Department. We're kind of on a day-to-day basis trying to get as much out as we can. I think I certainly would want to keep an eye on the levels of private capital flows. And like I said, we feel quite good about that, and we want to see more of that going forward. There was a lot raised by venture funds several years ago. I think we'd like to see more of that investment taking place. We'd like to continue to see financial institutions think about how they can take into account the energy transition. But I wish I could pick a single moment, but we're kind of working day to day.
It's a big story.
All right. Ethan, thanks a lot. It was so good to see you in a different role. Really good to catch up with you.
Thank you, Ethan Zindler,
from the Treasury Department. He is a climate counselor for the U.S. Treasury Department, formerly of Bloomberg NEF.
Yep, that's right. BNEF here at the BNEF conference here in Midtown Manhattan. Talk about transition to cleaner energy.
This is the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live each weekday, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern, on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.